Welcome to the Diet Doctor Podcast with Dr. Brett Scher. Today, it's my pleasure to be joined by Dr. Sarah Hallberg. She's the medical director at Virta Health and the medical director at Indiana University, where she runs a weight loss and diabetes management clinic there. And you've probably heard of Sarah because of the amazing work she's been doing along with the folks at Virta Health with their scientific data and their studies, which has really upended the way we see diabetes. Diabetes has always been taught as a disease that is chronic that you just manage. But what they've done is they've disrupted that whole concept to now show we can reverse diabetes, we can normalize people's numbers, and get them off their medications while helping them feel great. So I'm so excited to have her on to discuss the work they've been doing and to discuss some of the maybe downfalls of the study, the way it was conducted, and maybe some of the problems with applying it to real-world scenarios. But these are the issues that we deal with on a regular basis. And you can see from her energy and her knowledge that she is a fantastic advocate in this field. So I really hope you enjoy this interview with Dr. Sarah Hallberg. Dr. Sarah Hallberg, thanks so much for joining me on the Diet Doctor Podcast today.
Thanks so much for having me.
So you've been very publicly well-known in the low-carb sphere ever since Virta Health came out with their study, first their 10-week study, then their one-year study. But in case anybody doesn't know you, give us a little background about how you got to this point in your career that you're basically upending how we treat and see diabetes.
Well, I got to this point through a little convoluted path, which in hindsight was the best way to get there. So I started out my career as an exercise physiologist and have my master's degree in that and worked for a while in cardiac rehab. Actually got into a fight with a cardiologist. That is the moment that I decided I was going to med school. So I didn't want to go since I was five. And then worked in primary care for a while and then was approached by IU, Indiana University Health, which is where I'm still currently the medical director at the obesity program there, approached me about starting the obesity program. And so I had to figure out what to do. Like, how do you solve the unsolvable problem is what I always used to say. And so I spent a long time reading everything. I mean, I read literature for a year to try to say, what can we do? Why does nothing seem to work? And what I really realized then was that the advice that I had been giving by it for almost 20 years at that point was really not based in evidence, that I just took what everybody told me and thought it was fact and went on and gave that misguided advice to my patients. So it was a real aha moment of, holy cow, you know, I've been contributing to this problem.
Right.
And so from day one, we opened the clinic at IU as a low-carb clinic, and quickly the focus changed from obesity, which was the original intention of the clinic, to diabetes, because that's what we were seeing the biggest impact in. I mean, you know, what was impossible, right? People's diabetes going away. I mean, where was that? That, you know, at that point, it was not in the literature. This was not a thing, if you will. And I got really mad. Because, you know, how can this just be for the patients at my small clinic? We did a small pilot study. Then I had the great fortune of running into Steve Finney at a conference, telling him I wanted to get funding for a larger study, and the rest is history.
Wow, that's fantastic. Now, what I find most remarkable is that you saw what other people don't see, or at least you acted upon it. And so what was different for you? Because so many physicians out there are trying to treat obesity. So many physicians out there are trying to manage diabetes. But somehow you were able to see the difference and say what we're doing isn't working and here's what we need to do. So many people don't take that next step. So I guess where I'm going with this is, what's different about you and how do we get more people to take that next step and realize that there's more out there?
Well, I think I had a really wonderful opportunity to have a moment to take some soul searching, so to speak, right? I mean, I had this opportunity where I really had a year to decide what we were going to do and, you know, spent all this time reviewing the literature and had that moment where I realized that I had been doing the wrong thing for people. And you know, I was able to pause and just say, oh my goodness, you know, you clearly are at a fork in the road at that point. Do I continue on with sort of the easy path that we know is wrong, right, but is what's readily accepted? Or do right. we consider trying something that there sure seems like there's more evidence? I mean, this was a number of years ago, so there wasn't as much evidence for it as there is today. I mean, black and white almost difference
right.
In the two times. But, you know, you then say, you know, what is my goal? And clearly my goal, and I think most healthcare providers, is our goal is to help people, is to really help people. And I knew from my almost decade in primary care that what I was doing was frustrating people with a low-fat advice. I knew that. I saw it. I had those moments where people were like, but I'm doing it. And in my own, like my own self, I doubted them. Like I did, like so many other providers right. did, that said, well, if you were just listening to me, right?
Right.
You know, I had those moments along the way, but I knew that I was just frustrating them. I knew that everybody, that couldn't be happening with all the people that we were seeing.
Right. Isn't it convenient how we put it on the patients that it's their fault, that they're just not doing a good enough job, instead of questioning the advice that we're giving?
Absolutely. But it just seemed so... It couldn't be that all these people were wrong, right? It couldn't be the advice, because I hadn't taken the time to go back and read until, again, I was setting up the obesity program. And then you just look at all the facts in front of you, you know, and you say, okay, I know I was frustrating people. We're way getting worse and we're continuing to do the same thing. Look, there's evidence for a different way of doing it. And ultimately, right, ultimately, you got to have your moral compass in check. And what is my goal? My goal is to do the best thing I can for my patients. So again, I had a little advantage over, you know, the situation presented a good advantage, and my experience in primary care gave me, I think, what I really needed, which was so much experience with frustration from patient standpoint to, you know, say, we're not going to do it that way anymore.
And then fortunately, you get connected with Dr. Finney, and as you say, the rest is history. And the rest is actually rewriting history, because med school, residency, fellowship, clinical practice, you are taught you manage diabetes. You adjust their insulin doses, almost always adjusting up. You add oral medications. You manage. You don't reverse. You don't take them off medications. And now it's a different story. It's a completely different land out there. It's a completely different world for diabetes, largely based on the study that you did.
Well, I mean, isn't it wonderful time for diabetes in diabetes care? Because what excites me more than anything is when you look at a patient and say you can reverse your type 2 diabetes, you know, you've given them so much, probably most importantly, control back in their life, right? Because they felt like they had just lost all control. You know, they continued to get worse. And so, you know, it's an exciting field to be in. It's an incredibly rewarding field to be in. I mean, it's just a great time to be in this space and really be able to see patients transform before your eyes.
Right.
It's an honor to be able to accompany them on that journey. It really is.
So let's talk about the study briefly. At the 1 year mark, there was 83% compliance with the diet, people who still stayed in it. The hemoglobin A1C reduced from 7.6 down to 6.3. 94% of the people either lowered or got off their insulin. And there were improvements in CRP and triglycerides and HDL and the ALT, the liver function test. Now, the LDL-C went up by 10%, but with no change in the ApoB, which is the more important marker. So these are revolutionary stats coming from a dietary management for diabetes. So you would think everybody would be getting in line, lining up and saying, yes, this is what we need to do to make this standard of care to treat diabetes, or type 2 diabetes. But that's not the case. People aren't lining up,
right? It's not a pill.
Yeah.
It's not a pill. So, you know, I'll say a couple of things that it's just so shocking. You know, over 50% of the adults in this country have diabetes or prediabetes. And, you know, what I say is, what if that was an infectious disease?
Right.
What if over 50% of the adults in this country had an infectious disease? What would we be doing collectively, right? This would be like the world's most nonpartisan thing, right? We would be all coming together and we would be doing anything and everything that we could to battle this. But it's got to do with food. So we're able to ignore it. And then the solution isn't a pill.
Yeah.
It's food again. And somehow, with results this remarkable, we're able also to say, okay, well, move on. And it shocks me. It truly does. I mean, this is a fantastic solution for people. They don't have to have surgery. They don't have to take yet another medication. And it's not just the diabetes that reverses. I mean, people feel better. It's remarkable the improvements people have in their overall quality of life. So I just excited to keep doing the research, plugging away, continue to talk about it, because I think our solution to our current health epidemic is in front of us.
Yeah. So there can be a couple of different pushbacks on the study. It wasn't randomized. Mm-hmm. It was only 1 year. It involved a very intensive management with very high touch. This isn't something where you see them in the office every 6 months. Is it applicable to the real world? Those are all sort of the pushbacks, I guess, that people would give to this study that I'm sure you've heard hundreds of times, if right. not more. So how do you address that to say this is still evidence that applies to the real world?
So first of all, as far as the non-randomization goes, you know, my pushback to that is, no, it wasn't randomized because we were doing a long-term trial. And if you don't include patient's choice in it, you're going to get a huge dropout. I mean, patients are the, you know, number one people who get to choose what they do, right? I mean, we can't be telling them. So we allowed patients to choose. Would you like to go into the intervention arm or would you like to continue on with standard of care? And so, you know, that is a critical piece without question to the long-term sustainability. And that goes to another point you had, which is generalizability. You know, do I think everyone in the world who has type 2 diabetes is going to choose to do this? I don't, but I think a lot of people will. Yeah. And so this is geared towards the people who are interested in reversing their disease, who don't want to have surgery in order to do that. And, you know, the idea that that's not a big, big percentage of the people who have type 2 diabetes is crazy. Of course it is.
Yeah. And that's what's most, I find so interesting, because when I talk to friends in endocrinology, one of my good friends who runs hormonesdemystified.com, you know, his main pushback is, yeah, everybody should be doing this. But in my personal experience, of just a small fraction actually want to do it. And that's what's so frustrating. How do we get people over that hurdle to understand how important this is and want to do it? Because we're so ingrained in our society that we need our grains, no pun intended, that we need our carbs, that it's too much of a sacrifice to do this type of diet. But on the other hand, you could say it's too much of a sacrifice to lose a limb or have kidney failure. And yet there's this disconnect there. So how do you see us getting more people over that hump? And it has to start sort of in the community with regular doctors and everyday doctors and not from Virta Health. So how do you see that disseminating?
No one is going to choose to do it who doesn't know it's an option.
Right.
I mean, that's the absolute bottom line. And so, you know, in many of my talks that I give, like in grand rounds and going to speak to various physician groups, I talk about diabetes reversal. I mean, and the take-home message is always, it is a reversible condition. I mean, you can do it with bariatric surgery, you can do it with extreme calorie restriction, or you can do it with a low carbohydrate approach. You know, no one should be choosing which one of those choices patients make other than the patient. But if they don't know that it's a choice, if they don't know that there's actually something that they can do about it, of course they're never going to choose it. So the number one thing we need to work on is just the concept and allowing people to understand that type 2 diabetes, it's very important to make sure we clarify it's type 2 diabetes,
right,
is a reversible condition, especially if you start early. So we just need to continue to work really hard. And I call on everyone. I certainly call on healthcare providers to talk to their patients about that. But I call on the general public too. You know, when you know someone, you know, they probably don't have any idea that this is something that they can take control of and that they can reverse. And I think the more and more that we get the word out, and I do think we're making a difference in that.
Sure.
But the more we can continue to work and get the word out that this is something patients can take control of themselves, the more people will choose it.
Now, what about governing bodies and guidelines, you know, the American Diabetes Association and the European version of that? And even, you know, family practice guidelines for managing diabetes. Why has this not taken those and made them totally revitalize their guidelines and include a low-carb diet? Is it simply because pharma influence? Is it because they think more data is needed? Is it because they're concerned about the LDL or the saturated fats? What kind of resistance are you getting there, and why do you think?
Well, clearly I think there was resistance there since my TED Talk was ignore the guidelines, right, on this. But since that time, we have made some good moves in the sense that just recently in the last few weeks, the American Diabetes Association and their European counterparts did come out with new recommendations, and they are now including low carbohydrate as a recommended eating pattern, you know, which is a move in the right direction. I don't know that it's as strong as a move because they still, for example, have DASH as a recommended eating pattern. And there's actually like the amount of evidence for DASH for type 2 diabetes is, you know, basically non-existent. In fact, in the one study that they cite, triglycerides actually worsened in the intervention group. So the evidence is there. I think they're starting to pay attention to it, the governing bodies, if you will, because the amount of evidence is just overwhelming. For example, there are 25 randomized controlled trials looking at a low carbohydrate intervention for type 2 diabetes. Five meta-analysis. You know, how many for the DASH study? Two. You know, I mean, so you can't, there's no comparison anymore. Mediterranean diet, you know, very few. I mean, there's no eating pattern that even comes close to the amount of randomized controlled trial evidence that there is for a low carbohydrate diet. And I'm going to offer again that we need to look beyond just the randomized controlled trial data. There are additional other studies in the low carbohydrate evidence base, including ours, that are longer term and maybe not controlled. Hmm. And once again, when we're looking at long term sustainability, patient choice, i.e. not randomization, is just going to be a key component.
Yeah, it brings up a great question about evidence and scientific research in general, the randomized controlled trial versus the just observational trial, patient choice trial, as you say. For a drug, a randomized trial is great.
It is. Right? Perfect.
But for a lifestyle choice that you have to buy into, randomized controlled trial may be not the best choice, and this is the better way to go, yet we're so ingrained in our brain that it has to be randomized to be the highest level of quality. And you bring up some good points that maybe that's not the best approach for this, because we want to know, does this work in the real world?
And does it work long term?
Yeah. And what your study showed is clearly the model at Virta works long term. Other studies have shown, maybe even outside that model, that a low carb diet works. But now your model has that higher level of touch.
Yes.
It's got the technology behind it. Mm-hmm. And it's got sort of the best of both worlds, the medical science and sort of the Silicon Valley tech flair to it. Now, do you think that is scalable to the hundreds of millions of patients that, you know, they're not hundreds, but the millions of patients that we need to help reverse this condition?
I do.
Yeah?
I do. And I think that's the key. And, you know, the point that you made earlier was, you know, this is a high touch situation. So, and that's not what we're normally doing. But wait a minute, that's what we need to be doing, right? Because let's face it, making a lifestyle change is hard. Okay, if it was easy, everyone would do it. So people who are embarking on this, who have the goal of reversing their type 2 diabetes, need to have a lot of support. And so the remote care model that we are utilizing at Virta is giving them that. And so, yes, this is the way that it can be scaled, because you can do away with the brick and mortar. You know, you can make it very convenient for patients. They can get their information. They can get their medication changes. They can get their support and their questions answered when it works for them. And so, and you know, yes, does the higher touch cost more money than going to the dietitian every other month or something like that? It does, but it saves money because with the dietitian, we're just continuing, we know, adding more medication. If we're seeing them, especially, I should say all dietitians, if they're recommending the standard of care, low-fat approach, we know that that causes progression of disease and more medication over time.
Right.
If we're doing our, yes, more intense, but very needed when you're doing something as difficult as a lifestyle change, if you're doing that, you can pull people off of medications. You can get rid of a disease that is financially crippling this country. So the high touch is absolutely needed and can be scaled and can be done financially cost-saving, in a cost-saving model, excuse me.
So why aren't insurance companies banging down your door to save money this way?
Well, and I think that is beginning.
Yeah.
So I think as we see, again, our continued results, we'll be seeing more and more people being able to offer Virta to their employees or their insured populations. And so, you know, as you brought up, too, that it was only 1 year, but we are looking forward to the publication of our 2-year data. So it's been recently submitted, and as you know, it can take a while to go through the actual publication process. But, you know, I can't get into the details of it, but what I can say is that, you know, we're really excited to show that our results are sustainable.
Mm-hmm.
And that's really exciting.
Yeah. Now, when you present data like this, so you generally present the average. Everybody does, right? That's how you present. You present an average. And what's helpful to know is, or do most of the people hit those averages, or are there huge swings? Do some people reduce their A1C from 8 down to 5.5, and others go from, you know, 6.8 to 6.7? Do some people have spikes in their LDL and some people have declines in their LDL or their ApoB? Can you give a sense of what kind of variation you have across that mean in your data?
Oh, sure. There's some variation, but actually much less than you would think. So what we see is that most people are getting better. Sure, with an average, some people are a little below and some people are certainly a little above. But let me bring up one of the important questions that you just posed, which is with the LDL cholesterol, right? Like, so, okay, the average, you know, ApoB didn't change, but were there patients who had skyrocketing ApoB? And actually, when we compared them to the control group, the variance there was not any different than what we would expect or what we saw with the control group. So in other words, we didn't see these, you know, huge rises out of a couple people that would give us reasons to be concerned.
Right.
So the variance was about what was seen with standard of care.
And I think that makes sense because the patient population you're working with is overweight, they're diabetic, and the patients that we see those rises in ApoB tend to be the leaner, healthier, non-diabetic individuals. So I think that's a sort of an interesting dichotomy. If we use your evidence to say nobody gets a rise in ApoB, obviously that's not true. There's certain subsets that do, and it looks like that's a fairly safe subset. But do you have a policy at Virta how to address that if it does happen? Because it's controversial, right? There's no one right answer. And when you have a big company and you have protocols in place, you have to be a little conservative, I would think, about that.
Yeah. Oh, yes, we do. I mean, we absolutely. I mean, we definitely take any change in any biomarker that may be concerning incredibly seriously, and we act upon it.
Yeah.
So, you know, we definitely, I mean, and I will tell you, you know, when we have a rise in LDL, whether it's someone who is healthier or someone who has metabolic disease, I sit down and we have a huge discussion about it. And I prescribe statins very often in that patient population. I want my patients to be better in everything. I want all of their risk factors to be controlled.
Right.
And that's absolutely my goal.
Yeah. And I think it's a good perspective if they still have metabolic disease. It's not like diabetes and metabolic disease goes away like that. It's a progression. So an elevated ApoB, as they're still on that progression, they still have insulin resistance. They may still have elevated inflammatory markers. That's a completely different situation than someone, these classic lean mass hyper-responders who they have absolutely no insulin resistance. Their inflammatory markers are perfect. Their HDL and triglycerides are perfect. Those are two different scenarios that need to be approached differently.
Yeah, I can say, you know, confidently, in the patient population that we treat, we don't often see a rise in LDL cholesterol.
Yeah.
Anyone that does, you know, what's important is each individual patient to all of us. I mean, we are each individual patient to be treated as an individual and not as an average.
Yeah.
So anyone who deviates from what normally we see is something that we get on top of and that we have a discussion with the patient and we treat.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
What about other side effects or, you know, adverse effects of the diet? People point to, you know, gallstones or even kidney stones or, you know, GI distress. And what have you seen that is really something that can happen? And what have you seen that is just people putting out information that really has no basis in reality?
Yeah, I mean, the side effects are that people feel great and they lose weight.
Yeah.
I mean, those are the big side effects. So a lot of these other things are just chatter. I mean, so from a gallstone standpoint, I mean, people think they can't do it. They don't have a gallbladder. Oh my gosh, so many of our patients don't have gallbladders, right? They do fine. And gallstones are caused from a low fat diet, right? Because the gallbladder isn't squeezing in response to fat that's consumed. So, you know, we certainly wouldn't expect formation with gallstones with a low carbohydrate, high fat diet. And kidney stones, I mean, do we see patients who have had a history of kidney stones get a kidney stone? Sometimes. But do we see like patients getting kidney stones who don't have a history of them a lot? And we don't. I mean, I think in the literature, there is very little about this in adults. In kids, there's about a 5% chance of forming a kidney stone with a ketogenic diet. That's what the literature also. We don't have any evidence of the risk increasing in adults, but it's also never been well studied. And I can just tell you that I haven't had a big problem with it in my practice. So.
Do you have any people that you see for an intake or any protocols that say if on the intake the patient has X, Y, and Z, they're probably not a good candidate to enroll in this?
So in other words, who is not a good candidate for a ketogenic diet? And really I've only come up with one, and that is anyone who has hyperchylomicronemia should absolutely not do a ketogenic diet. So they have to be on an almost no-fat diet.
Right.
But that's, you know, one case every 1 to 2 million people. Otherwise, you know, have I done this in, you know, I mean, patients who have had liver transplants, kidney transplants, I mean, I've utilized it across the board. And, you know, the hyperchylomicronemia thing is something you would have to consider seriously in a child. But as an adult, I mean, the adult would know about it already because these are people who get pancreatitis all of the time. And it can actually be a fatal disease. It's genetic. So usually you're not surprised by a case of that.
Now, with the rise in type 2 diabetes in teens and adolescents, is that something you're starting to see as well? Or you've just VertiFocus only on adults at this point?
Only on adults at this point, right?
Okay.
But yeah, I think we're going to eventually have to expand because especially if we continue with the trends we're currently seeing, because of course, type 2 diabetes is, you know, it's not an unheard of case to see in an 8-year-old anymore. And
sure.
That's like unbelievably concerning.
Yeah. And what about bone loss? Actually, that was another side effect I meant to ask about, because that's out there in the chatter world that there you risk increased bone loss, especially in elderly women on a keto diet.
Well, I'm smiling because hold the phone on that.
We can get some data coming out on that too?
The data is coming out.
Excellent. Mm-hmm. Okay. Mm-hmm. All right. Now, another topic that gets a lot of attention for type 2 diabetes and weight loss with some very good results is intermittent fasting and time-restricted eating. And just saying intermittent fasting can mean anything from a 16-hour fast to a 16-day fast. And so it gets a little confusing. And I know there are some people within Virta who are not proponents of fasting, but I think the devil is in the detail when we talk about what kind of fasting. So is there any discussion about fasting, any use of fasting or time-restricted eating in your protocols?
Well, when someone tells me that they're fasting, my absolute first question is, what does that mean?
Yeah.
So I think there's data on time-restricted eating, and if patients want to do that, I think that's fine. So I would like to see us do away with the word fasting unless we're really talking about long-term fasting, which is not something that I recommend at all. Time-restricted eating, where patients, you know, keep their food intake during certain hours of the day, I think that's fine. You know, they're not going 24 hours without food or protein. I don't support that idea at all. But time-restricted feeding, for people who choose to do it, I think is a very reasonable thing. And I guess, again, there's some data to support that. So it's something that we would talk to our patients to make sure that they're doing appropriately. But if they were interested in it, we would support them in doing that.
And the concern with going 24 hours, is that from the protein loss, muscle mass loss mostly?
Also, yes. And then refeeding syndrome too, which is a real thing.
Yeah.
So, you know, we don't support that. There needs to be data behind that. And I think the only data that exists right now is from George Cahill from many, you know, decades ago, and supports the idea that we have muscle loss when we do prolonged fasts. So,
yeah. I think that's where the data gets really confusing, because it's what type of patient population are you talking about? Are they already thin and lean, or are they obese with fats, plenty of fat stores to lose? What's the duration and how you measure it? And I think it gets very conflicting. So I can see why Virta would say, look, until we have more evidence saying this is safe, let's stay away from it. But then you have people like Jason Fung and Megan Ramos at IDM program who are using it with great success and safely. And I want you guys to get together. I want everybody to sort of agree on this. And I guess it's not going to happen for the time being.
It's not. At Virta, number one, we are going to only practice things that are evidence-based. And so, you know, we'll wait for evidence, and we're open to any evidence that comes out. But, you know, we are going to, number one, I mean, we are an evidence-based practice.
Yeah.
Without question.
Yeah. So what about exercise and the use of that? Because that can be a double-edged sword for some people as they're trying to lose weight. And if they're not ready for exercise, it can cause injuries. Sometimes it can spark hunger. But yet at the same time, it can be a very important part of long-term health. So how do you incorporate exercise recommendations into your program?
So the best time to get someone to exercise is when they ask you about exercise. So in other words, it's not from day one, because you're asking them to make a huge lifestyle change. If you're telling them that they have to eat differently and now they have to exercise too, that's overwhelming. So again, my background is in exercise physiology. I want everyone to exercise. I mean, exercise is fantastic, but when do you get people exercising? And when do you get people exercising where they'll stay exercising? Is when they come to you because they're feeling better, because they know that they're healthier. They have more energy. They've lost weight. The pain in their joints isn't as bad. That's when you can get someone exercising and they'll stick with it.
Right.
So it's, and there's no set time for that. It's not like, oh, it's been, you know, 6 months, you need to be exercising. No, because for someone, it might be a couple months that they want to start exercising. And for some people, it's a year. I mean, it's each person needs to make their own choice on when it's going to be right for them. And we're absolutely here to encourage them.
That makes a lot of sense. Mm-hmm. And thus the benefit of that high touch, frequent follow-up, personalized care, you can get an idea of when that time frame is. Again, not seeing them every 6 months, once a year, or something like that, where you're not going to have a good time frame on how they're feeling and how they're progressing.
Right. Because what if they want to exercise at, you know, 3 months, and you don't see them again for 6 months?
Yeah.
Right. You missed your opportunity to talk to them and engage them and help them. Right. Wait. Because what do you do? Like, you need to be there with good advice and support. And so, again, when that comes for patients, we want to be there at the moment that it comes for them, to be able to support them and guide them and help them make it something that can be sustained as part of a new healthy lifestyle going forward.
Makes sense. Now, in addition to your positions as chief medical officer at Virta Health.
Actually, I'm not. That would be Steve.
I apologize. That would be Steve. Remind me again.
I'm medical director.
Medical director. Uh-huh. Medical director at Virta, and then at IU.
Mm-hmm.
You're also very involved on the policy side of things and trying to get guidelines changed. Tell me about some of the work you're doing there and what you see as what's coming on the horizon.
Well, yes, my partner in crime there is the wonderful Nina Teicholz, as you know. And so Nina has done some unbelievable, amazing work in DC and as far as trying to get our guidelines changed. And I help her out. And one of the things was that I just recently got to go and give a testimony at a congressional briefing for the working group called Food as Medicine. And so, you know, again, gave my discussion about diabetes and how is it that we're not doing more. Here's a solution that can help. And so we got really great response there. So I'm excited that and very hopeful that, again, we can see guidelines changed. Of course, the American Diabetes Association guidelines, we're seeing evidence of that already. But we're poised for the 2020 dietary guidelines coming out soon. I mean, 2020 is not far down the road. And so we are really looking forward to hoping that they focus on evidence-based medicine. You know, we're supporting many evidence-based candidates on the committee. And again, we just continue to work in that direction. Evidence-based policy is what we need.
Yeah, it's such an interesting term to use, because if you asked the people who were involved in the last guidelines, is this evidence-based, they would shake their heads and say, yes, it is. I mean, I think it's clear they believed they were following evidence-based guidelines, but there are a lot of holes in that, and the quality of the evidence was poor. But yet, that's what they were. That's what they believed in. So, how do we get them to change if they already believe they're following evidence-based guidelines?
I mean, it's very clear that they did not. Yeah. So, you know, the National Academy of Sciences was very, very clear in their report and recommendations about the dietary guideline process. So one of the things that NINA and the Nutrition Coalition did was actually get Congress to mandate what was really the first peer review of the dietary guidelines, the 2015 dietary guidelines, by the National Academy of Sciences, and they appropriated $1 million to that effort. And the report came out in just over a year ago, September of 2017, and basically said that the dietary guidelines, I mean, what impacts so many Americans is not based on rigorous methodology and has to be reviewed and completely restructured. And so, again, we have the recommendations there. And what we're really working on right now is to make sure that those recommendations from the National Academy of Sciences actually get put into action.
Yeah. So when you were testifying, you said you were testifying in front of Congress. Is that right?
Yeah. So it was a working group, a congressional working group called Food is Medicine. Correct.
So it's so interesting, because I would hope they wouldn't have such a strong bias going into it, that they would be, you know, they're not scientists. It's not like they've made their career defending a certain guideline or a certain way of eating, so that they would be more open to it. Did you find that they were a little more receptive than when you talked to, you know, a group of endocrinologists or a group of researchers or a group of people who are already involved in the American dietary guidelines? Did you find a different reception there?
No, I actually feel like I get a really reasonable reception even from physicians. I think when you pause with them for a little bit and talk to them, most of them, of course, there's always exceptions, are interested and, you know, think you can see them kind of reflecting on it. And then they agree that really makes sense. And, you know, the same thing happened at the briefing. So there was a lot of interest in it. A lot of people asked for my slides afterwards. So, you know, I'm hopeful that, you know, is this one thing going to be, you know, the end all be all change? Absolutely not. We need to continue to work to do things like this, chip away, if you will, at the old dogma of how we treat and recommend nutrition to people. Yeah. And we'll get there.
And how much is industry and pharma fighting this?
You know, I think what we're seeing as far as industry goes is there is some shift. I'm not saying that there hasn't been barriers due to industry, due to pharma, but with industry at least, you're seeing some companies begin to shift to the whole foods idea and at least put some thought. I don't think they're doing enough. No, you know, no arguments there, but put some thoughts to this direction and how are they going to survive in a world where the consumers are asking for something different. And so, you know, I hope at the end of the day, at some point they become an ally in getting good food. But there's no question, you know, that they've been contributing to the problem for a while too.
Absolutely. Well, I know we're short on time today because you have to run downstairs and give your talk. I appreciate you giving us time this morning.
Absolutely.
So thank you so much. What I know you've got the 2-year data coming up. What else is on the horizon that you can get people excited about, and where can they go to learn more about you?
Yeah, we have a number of papers actually that are going to be coming out. So 2-year data, we've got a liver paper, a sleep paper. We've got some really exciting data coming out. And so, yes, to learn more, you can go to vertahealth.com. We will always be putting up all of our published papers there for people to be able to read. And keep watching. I think the field is changing, and I think we're going to see guidelines really start to be impacted soon. And like I said, I'm excited. It's good change. It's a needed change.
That's fantastic. Well, thank you for all your work and your advocacy. It's wonderful to see the whole field change and know that we can start to reverse this condition of type 2 diabetes. It's wonderful.
Thanks so much. Thank you. Thanks for having me.